Going online without ExpressVPN is like confessing your sins at church, but everyone can read your mind. You may not have anything to hide, but is it really everyone's business? This is why everyone needs a VPN, because all your traffic flows through their servers. Internet service providers, including mobile network providers, know every single website you visit. ExpressVPN reroutes 100% of your traffic through secure, encrypted servers, so your internet service provider can't see your browsing history. ExpressVPN will hide your IP address, making it extremely difficult for third parties to track your online activity. All you have to do is fire up the app and click one button to get protected. I use ExpressVPN personally to protect my online activity from hackers, spammers, and the deep state. Protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/matter. That's expressvpn.com/matter. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/matter. There's a new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions called Morning Kick. It combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. All you do is mix with water, stir, and enjoy. It tastes like strawberry lemonade, not like ground-up spinach. Morning Kick is part of my daily routine. It's replaced orange juice in my life as the first place I go when I wake up. And since I've been drinking it, I've had better digestion and more energy. For me, that's important now that I have a newborn who, let's just say, doesn't always sleep like a baby. My health is important to me, just like it's important to you. I want to be the best version of myself spiritually, mentally, and physically. If you feel sluggish, it's worth giving Morning Kick a try. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/Harris for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/HARRIS today. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary. We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. There's a lot of material out there to talk about, and I'm not sure if we'll get to all of it, but I do want to talk about some things that I've had bookmarked on my phone for the last few days, some of them now, I suppose, over a week. Russell Moore put out an article at Christianity Today about slander, which many are speculating is in response to Megan's book, which would be true to form for him, because when he's received criticism in the past, he does not tend to acknowledge such criticism with naming names and addressing it directly. He tends to do a very general approach where you don't know specifically who he's talking about, but you can read between the lines and guess, or you know who fits the description. And I think there's a strategic reason probably he does this. He's not the only one. There's a lot of people in evangelicalism who do this. I don't know how many times I have heard someone with a platform in evangelicalism start talking about some pushback they've gotten, and the description they give sounds a lot like something I've said. There's been times, actually, I'm the only one I know of who's said what they're talking about, but they're not going to name me. And I think, I don't want to speculate too much, but I think there's a reason for that. And I'll just leave it at that. But Russell Moore may be responding to Megan Basham with this piece, and we'll talk about that a little bit. There's also a podcast that he did recently with Latasha Morrison, who's the author of Be the Bridge. I've done a whole thing on that. It's critical race theory harmonized with Christianity, or an attempt to harmonize. You can't really do that, but she attempts to do that. And in that book, this became sort of a minor issue in the primary for the governorship of Virginia, because Glenn Youngkin, who is now the current governor of Virginia, had been, I believe it was, leading these studies at his church. So when I said that Glenn Youngkin was influenced by, or didn't have a problem with, critical race theory, and he's the one that the Republicans are electing to deal with it, it was because of this in part. So that is how far back I have to go, though. I think that was, what, 2021, 2020? I'm trying to remember now when he was first elected, when that the race was, the primaries were going on, maybe 2021. But anyway, that's how some of you who listen to the podcast may know of Latasha Morrison. But she did write that book, and that's what she's known for. And there's these Be the Bridge groups at various churches that are supposed to promote racial reconciliation. And I've had people from churches that have done that tell me it's split up the church. It's I've never heard of good fruit coming from it. But she was with Russell Moore, too. And so I want to talk about that podcast a little bit. And then we will talk about N.T. Wright, a little clip of him comparing gun rights to abortion. I have not listened to it. That's going to be kind of a cold listen where I'm going to be listening to it in real time as you're listening to it and responding. And what else do we have? We have some funding. I'm going to talk about some funding of a certain foundation called the Templeton Foundation, and probably not the full extent of what they've done, but a little bit about what they've been up to, and really reinforcing the point that Megan Basham made in her book, a point that Enemies Within the Church has made, a point I've made over the years, is that there are funnels of money going to bad actors, can we put it that way, people who are subverting the church. And I don't think this is necessarily all coordinated, like everyone's in a back room with cigars. I think this is just the way things are set up. There's a chart. I don't have it in front of me, but there is a chart I know I've seen many times that show right-wing versus left-wing donations. So it was really donations to Democrats versus Republicans. And the different industries people come from who donate. And it's startling when you see it. I mean, it's mostly blue. It's mostly Democrat donors in many of the influential fields. And so they just have a lot more money. And they got there over time. This wasn't something overnight, but they have a lot more expendable income to put towards their political projects. And if an evangelical is far left enough to use that money, whether or not it's subverting evangelicals or it's just to push the needle forward on leftist objectives and other areas, they might get that. And there's more available to them. I'm not saying there aren't foundations and grants coming from more conservative think tanks and organizations, but there are much more coming from left-wing organizations. And so that doesn't mean all you're seeing in your church or your denomination or your Christian organization is the result of leftist funding. I think that's kind of a cop-out. I think that there's a lot of ideological reasons for what's happening. But in certain areas, yes, the scales are somewhat tipped in ways that you might not be aware of. We're going to talk about that a little bit today as well, if we have time, and we should have time for that. And then we're going to do kind of a blast from the past. I'm going to go back to a J.D. Greer sermon from 10 years ago, I think it was, on diversity. I'm not going to play it, but I have the transcript. And the reason I want to go back to it in part was because I thought it was a new sermon. I thought it was from the end of July. And it turns out Summit Church just, I guess, re-released it online. So they're still backing this narrative up. They're still okay with this message being put out there. And I want to talk about it, though, because when I was looking at it, I thought, wow, you know, it's just interesting to see the fruit of this. That this was 10 years ago, J.D. Greer preached this particular sermon, and to see what has happened since then. And what I would say is the negative fruit, the division that's come with it. And so often these guys blame everyone who critiques them for the division, but I think the division comes from their message. So that's a preview. And if anyone has any questions, I know I've certainly been active on X the last few days. On this whole post-war consensus stuff, and was Churchill good or bad, and then a little bit on IVF too, and I actually found some interesting things about IVF I did not know. I don't know if it's just because it was updated, but one of the things I saw was that should I really get into this? Maybe I should stop myself from getting into this, because this is maybe the third episode I talk about this topic, but I get pushback for it, right? So it forces me to look at things a little deeper. And there's so much to say. There's so much, like, it's such a big topic and there's so many moving parts, but some of the overly simplistic responses, I'm just more and more convinced they're not helpful. And we really need to target directly the ethical issues and the moral violations, horrible moral violations that often accompany the practice, instead of doing a very simplistic pro or con thing. And then oftentimes with bad information about what's actually going on or what it actually is. But there was, what was it? I looked up a study. Oh, here it is. Okay. So this was on my ex. So apparently, I didn't know this, but you're going to hear this a lot with people, I think very oftentimes well-meaning, but people in the anti-abortion camp who understandably have a problem with IVF because of so many of the moral issues that often accompany it. And you'll hear it thrown out that with IVF, there are anywhere, they'll say, from 85 to 99. I've seen numbers all in the middle there, but like very high numbers for eggs that are, well, fertilized. So it would be embryos that are discarded or lost in some way. And this is often bandied about, though, unfortunately, in ignorant ways, sometimes careless ways, where you're not sure, like, because you could be talking about selectively getting rid of these embryos because you don't want them, you have too many of them, right? You could be talking about they didn't meet a certain standard, or they were genetically, they had Down syndrome or something, right? And so getting rid of them for that reason. You could also be talking about a natural process, really, that occurs in healthy pregnancies, or I shouldn't say in healthy pregnancies, that occurs though in a natural state, where you may have a healthy pregnancy, but there are other embryos that end up dying. This actually happens with twins quite a bit, around 10 to 20% of the time, apparently, when there's twins, one of the twins doesn't make it and the pregnancy is lost and the other twin does. So estimates are that, you know, this is somewhere up, this is like 70% of embryos are actually lost in the womb, and nothing to do with IVF, right? But I found out that in IVF situations, they have a clinical pregnancy rate of over 60%. The actual live birth rate is still below 50%, though, which I thought was interesting, because that's actually, I thought they were, I looked up stuff, this was, must have been a few years ago now, but that they were equivalent, and I guess they're not anymore. In IVF situations, actually, there is, according to some studies, less of a percentage of embryonic loss. So I don't quite understand all the ins and outs of everything related to this, but I did read enough of the study to understand the point they were trying to make. And yeah, regarding specifically what you would call natural reduction or spontaneous reduction, IVF apparently has up to or a rate of over 60%, and then actual live birth of just below 50%. Whereas it's just weird to me. It's just odd. I don't know. I thought about it. I was like, what would explain this? And I think some of this, it may be the fact that in that process, the people who are candidates for it are, they have hormones, they're taking a lot of progesterone and that kind of thing. And this, they want the womb to be an environment that is as receptive to an embryo as possible. And they're monitoring it. And maybe that's what makes sense of that. But very interesting to me. So anyway, we can talk about that if people have questions about that. But I do see people coming into live chat, and I don't know why people can't believe this. Made it to another live stream. T. James Boone says, Jimmy Starfish says, I can't believe I made it to a live stream. Believe it. You're here. You are here. Hi, Dreamer. How are you doing? So let's talk about Russell Moore stuff first. Shall we do that? Let's talk about his interview with Latasha Morrison, the author of Be the Bridge. Some of the things she says, and then some of the things he says. I think it's very fascinating. So let's start with this. I'm just going to play you little segments here because I listened to it.
for the distribution of food. And so I think that's something that we have to see, that there was an adjustment made. And and scripture goes on to say in that, and the word of God spread. And so at that point, there was a hindrance coming because there was a lack of unity. And we see that the word of God spread. And we see that with Peter and, you know, just the eating of food and what was going to be required of the Gentiles and what wasn't going to be required of the Gentiles. We see that with Paul and, you know, and we see this through scripture, but I think sometimes we need help really fully seeing what was underneath and what was at play there. We completely miss that because when we read the Bible, a lot of times we think of ourselves, we put ourselves as the marginalized. You know, when we read the book of Esther, we see ourselves as Esther, you know, being persecuted rather than, no, we're like Haman.
How does a pastor...
Some of you will notice that seems very heavily edited. I don't know why. I don't know what was said and what they were cutting out, but very heavily edited. So the point she's making, though, I'm just going to go to the passage. It's Acts chapter 6. This is the passage she's talking about. Acts 6 verse 1 says, "Now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of food." Now, I'm going to stop there. John Calvin says about this. He actually says, well, it doesn't mean they were being overlooked. It just means that someone was complaining about it. The Hellenistic Jews thought they were being overlooked. So I guess there's a question about that. But it says, "So the 12 summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, 'Look, it's not desirable for us to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables. Therefore, brethren, select from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of this task.'" And then, of course, they put in charge. Stephen is one of them. Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, if I'm saying the names right, Timon, Parmenas, Nicholas, and so those guys all have Greek names. And a lot is made about this. I've seen this. Every guys who I would consider somewhat woke, everyone from Carl Ellis to Eric Mason to, like, they all, it seems like, to use this example of people who are disenfranchised, these Greek widows, because of some racism of some kind. And then that inspires the office of deacon, that inspires the apostles to specifically pick these Greek people to go minister to them. And the implications, if that's true, their reading of it, you might want to think about those implications a little bit, because that would mean that, I guess, like, you could extrapolate from that, that I guess if Black people are the marginalized in the scenario, which is often the parallel made, that white people should just go, I guess, hire Black people to help them or something, like, they, because it's not something that they should get involved with, which is kind of the opposite of what they're trying to say. But I don't know if that read, well, I do know. It's not the correct reading of the passage. And it's a novel reading, I think. What you really have in that passage is people who speak one language and people who speak another language. And people who speak Greek are thinking that they have been looked over, and they want some attention. So this is what happens. And sorry, I'm distracted by something right now. All right, we're good. So this is what happens. And anyway, I think that the point that Latasha Morrison is trying to make here essentially is she wants to ensure that people do kind of a redistribution thing. And that's not what you see in the passage. It's not that one group is marginalized and neglected, and it's because of some, we don't know that it's because of some racism or some innate hatred they have for Greek-speaking peoples or something like that. It's just, really the moral of it is there was an issue that the apostles could not address. It took too much bandwidth and away from more important things. And so they assigned people of good character who were able to bridge that language barrier and take care of it. That's what you get from the passage. So anyway, let's keep going. There's a few other things in here. Let's go to this part of the conversation.
Let's overshadow the other. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to think about that even today and what's happening in our climate. What do we want history to say about us?
Yeah.
Where do we stand in that? Where people are having this conversation is not to defend them, because there were choices that they made in light of the gospel.
Yeah.
There are choices that we are making in light of the gospel. And so what does the word of God say? What does Jesus say about justice? What does Jesus say about feeding the poor? What does Jesus say about the least of these?
I had a white.
I'm trying to remember why I wanted to play that clip, because I put in my notes defending white supremacists because they did good things. I don't know why I wrote that down. I think she must be talking about maybe if I go a little earlier than the let's see if I go a little earlier, if it makes sense.
Genuine insight from people from the past, while also recognizing this is horrific sin and injustice.
Yeah, I think we tell the truth. And we've gotten so far away from the truth. And it's the truth that really makes us free, where I can say there's this duality, where I can say those people made some really bad decisions and choices, and I can talk about that. But I could also say, but these are some good things that they did. That's the full truth. Like, yeah. You know.
Okay. I guess I remember now more why I wanted to play that. So this is the thing, though, that people like myself have been saying for a while, that people are flawed and there are oftentimes good things that you can find in someone and also bad things. And the woke side has typically framed things as if founding fathers, founding generation people are irredeemable in some way because of complicity in something that was beyond the pale. And so there's no hope for ever. We should take down their statues. We should treat them as villains in history and this kind of thing. And I've tried to make the point that going back that far, there's going to be a lot of assumptions that don't comport with egalitarian ideas we have today. But there's obviously, there is a place of profound strength morally in a lot of these people, sacrifice, duty, character traits that are actually in short supply today, chivalry. And it would do us well to go back to some of these things. And that's a point, though, people, even the neoconservatives, right, who tend to buy into these critiques more strongly than I would, tend to make this point. And it's interesting to hear someone also make that point. So I just wanted to point that out, that I don't know if there's a shift going on that I don't know. I don't know what that means, but this could be used to defend people like Robert E. Lee if they wanted, right? This could be used to defend a lot of people that they consider horrible, beyond the pale people from history going on that logic. So yeah, the full truth. Edwin Ramirez says the full truth in quotes. That's, I think, what we've been after, I think, is my point. Like, she's trying to claim the mantle of the full truth, but that is the very thing that we've been trying to, like, say. There's a lot of, it's complicated. There's, people are complicated, and having a one size fits all paradigm for someone is oftentimes a oversimplification. All right, I only have, I think, three or four more little areas that I wanted to play here, so let's move forward here. George Floyd. I'm not even going to play this. I'm just going to mention, no, actually I'm going to play this, because actually Russell Moore, I think, is the one who says something here that's kind of oof.
A lot has happened since
yes.
then. But if you think about the,
so just to put it in context, they're talking about George Floyd's death here. Let me go back a little more.
And the things that we preach and teach, you know, do we believe in redemption?
Yeah. It's only been 4 years since the murder of George Floyd. A lot has happened since
yes.
then. But if you think about those months immediately after, it seemed like something had really changed.
Yes.
As though people who maybe previously didn't want to even think about these things did.
Yeah.
That has not been sustained.
Yeah.
At least in my view, you might disagree with that, but I think we're certainly not in the same place we right. were then.
Right.
What did we do wrong in the George Floyd era?
Yeah, I think it was performative. I think people were doing stuff and making changes, not out of conviction, but out of being called out. So it was real performative. I think it was a start. And I think if there would have been different leadership at that time, I think people would have leaned into it a little bit more. But there was a double down, an erasure, and a changing of narrative. And the fringe, some of the fringe things that happened, unfortunately, from the church of CRT that took the life out of it, you know, that were things that weren't even true. So anything to do with history became CRT. Anything to do with Black history became CRT. We started banning things and conversations of people who were still living and breathing. I mean, Ruby Britt.
All right, let's just stop there for a moment. I hope you see the overall point. This is something I've seen over and over with leftists. There are things that happen where you make some progress and then it's overshadowed this happens in history, right? But it is characteristic of leftists to win a political victory of some kind. Their guy's in office. They're controlling politics. They get all this DEI stuff passed and approved in corporations. They remove hundreds of monuments. They make everyone hyper aware of race and scare people into complicity. They win a sweeping victory on the issue. And then not long afterward, they lament about it. Like, well, we didn't achieve what we wanted. We didn't go far enough. We didn't reach the goal we were looking for. And who's always to blame? It's these fringy, racist, sexist, homophobic, whatever. These bigots that are hiding somewhere, just waiting to trap them and ruin everything. And Russell Moore, I mean, he frames it as a murder, first of all. So I hope you caught that. He frames it as the murder of George Floyd, which we know from the autopsy now that's not true. But he says it's a murder. And so he's buying into the narrative. And then, you know, where did we go wrong? It's like everything's been reversed. And this is one of the engine. This is the engine, I think. This is one of the things that keeps the left doing what they're doing, because they're perpetually in this spot of thinking that there's more powerful forces that are holding them back. And Christians, even though if the evangelical elites almost entirely belong to them or are neutralized by them, it doesn't really matter. They focus on what they call the fringe voices who disagree with them and then blame them for why things aren't the way they want them to be. And I would submit to you that things will never be the way they want them to be, no matter what they do. They are bucking against creation most of the time. They're trying to change social institutions to arrive at some kind of a utopian state, a DEI paradise that doesn't actually exist, that won't exist. And really what conservatives, I think, would say is that you have to take into account the populations that you're dealing with and the barriers and the constraints that you have, and then come up with the best policies for how to meet those. The left is much more ideological generally, and they want whatever their ideal is on paper, abstractly speaking, to be the state of affairs. And when it doesn't reach that, then they have to come up with a scapegoat of some kind. And so you just see it again here. All right, let's talk about wokeness too. The term woke, which was seen as a very positive term, is not now. And here's how they deal with it. It's just funny. They're very sensitive now to being even called something like woke, which I just thought was really rich. So here's a little clip on that.
But we don't understand systemic racism.
You know, that is a good point that Ruby Bridges seems to, I think, a lot of people to be way back in history. Like a Harriet Tubman, she's not.
She's my parents are older. My mom is older than Ruby Bridges. My mom is 72. So you're talking to someone where you're trying to deny a history that not just I have lived, but my parents have lived, and the impact of that. You know, my grandfather, who was 91 years old, just passed in September.
I'm wondering if I got the wrong time stamp here. Let me go back a little more.
Just levels of depravity, you know, that I can't even imagine that, you know, we are a people that understand depravity, but we don't understand systemic racism.
You know, that is a good.
So I'm not sure where the quote was. I put down the wrong timestamp. Maybe it's on 30 instead of 20. All right, let me try one more thing. And if I'll just skip it if I can't find the correct timestamp.
To do what's in their power. And what they're doing is helping sustain some of the brown people and some of the allies and accomplices that they have.
Okay, I can't find it. So there was a point, I can't find exactly where it was for some reason. I must have written down the wrong timestamp, where they do, they're sensitive to being called woke, and that this is some kind of name call. This is some kind of way to illegitimize what they're saying. And I just thought this was the funniest thing to me, because it's not like conservatives came up with the term woke. Christian conservatives didn't say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to name call them woke. It was a term that they used of themselves not that long ago, even. And all of a sudden, you know, it was turned against them, as because we know what that is now. We saw what happened in 2020. And we say, oh, that's what woke is. Well, we're against that. That's associated with all kinds of terrible things. And now they don't want to be called that in general. And so now if a conservative uses it about them, they're so sensitive to it. And it's just, it's funny. It's rich. It's like, you can't make it up. All right, let's, okay. I just have one more thing I want to play from this. So this is Russell Moore at the end. And it reinforces a little bit of what I was talking about earlier, how they can gain all these victories and yet they still feel like perpetual losers.
When Latasha Morrison brought it up, is because I think we tend to have this wrong-headed assumption that time itself will solve all of these problems. And I think if we've seen anything in the past couple of years, we have seen the ways that things can go backward and things can go off course in churches and countries and cultures when it comes to these questions of racial justice and reconciliation. And I can think about in my own life being in the fourth grade when our school was integrated, not legally integrated, that had happened long before, but actually integrated with a group of African-American students. That was not terribly, terribly long ago in the sweep of history. And we still have a lot left to confront. But what I liked about this conversation, among many other things, but is that there really was a sense of hope that she has. And I think there are a lot of people who are maybe the most effective right now who are realistic about where things are. We don't just wish this away. We can look at what's happened over the past several years and say, this is awful. But who aren't at the point of cynicism that just says, what can you do? This is just the way that it is. She didn't yield either of those things. And I think that is hope giving.
Okay. We're going to stop there. Would you think this guy has his the people he wants in office, the policies he'd like, the ideology that he subscribes to, would you think it's in a winning position from listening to that? And look what he's holding on to, Ruby Bridges. Who is the subject of, there's a Norman Rockwell photo of Ruby Bridges going into integrate a school. I think it was in Louisiana or somewhere. He's holding on to something for, I don't know how many years ago that was, but the schools are integrated. So he's saying, well, I guess it wasn't that long ago, and it just makes him sad. Like, okay, but like, where's the... It's just interesting to me, these guys who leftists who they're getting the policies they want for the most part, and yet they're still not satisfied. They're just not happy with it. I think he is a really nasty person. Yeah, that's what Trump said about him. I'll take some more questions. Not Ruby Ridge. No, not Ruby Ridge. Ruby Bridges. You can look her up. Hannah Harris says, hey, what are some of your favorite resources for accurate history, particularly of U.S. history? If you're looking for curriculum, I'm not, my child is not that old yet, so I haven't had to do this myself, but Brian McClanahan has McClanahan Academy. Tom Woods has Liberty Classroom, and both of those things, I think they're for probably high schoolers more, but they have material and curriculum apparently for helping, at least assisting, if not being an entire curriculum. I've been told that the Tuttle Twins, is it Tuttle Twins, have good stuff? I've never looked at it, but I've been told they have good stuff, which is also associated with Tom Woods for younger children. I've also been told, I think the Ron Paul curriculum isn't that bad. I don't know. I've been told that there is a book, I think it might be out of print. I'm not sure if you can find a PDF called The War Between the States, which is it's a Civil War textbook. And someone I know who teaches said it's the best they've ever seen, the most comprehensive Civil War textbook. I don't know other than that, unfortunately, as far as your general comprehensive surveys of history. I actually taught American history, or at least proctored. I don't know what you call that when you're teaching online. They call it teaching, but sometimes it doesn't feel that way. But I did at least proctor grade papers, you know, administer lessons and so forth for American History Survey. And the way that textbooks are going now in college, this was on an undergrad level, are they're not really textbooks. They're like you read a little bit, you do a game or you do a test or quiz and you read a little bit. They're very interactive. Watch a video. They're not like what I was used to growing up, where you just have a tangible, like pages of information. Right. So, I don't know what's out there. I think there's a lot of resources out there now, and it's hard to sift through them because most of them probably are not that great, but those are a few places you can at least start to look, and hopefully that helps. My kids learn stuff from watching shows, watching the shows. Oh, the Tuttle Twins, I think. Okay. Are the Tuttle Twins a show? Okay, maybe that's what they are. I didn't know that. Question, have some Christians been too close for too long to Democrats that are now they are compromised? I think it's just the Democrats have power, and the Christians who want to be well-loved or well-liked, and they want to remain employed, and they don't want to be canceled, and they operate at a higher level, they're going to cater that kind of thing. And in their circle of friends, they're probably going to be more Democrats. Okay, let's move on here and talk about, what are we going to talk about? Russell Moore's article. Yeah, when to respond to slander. This is kind of a basic article, I think. So it's pretty short. But he says that there was a woman who came to him about a conflict and wasn't sure what to do. And she said that you seem to mostly ignore it when people lie about you. Is that because it would be wrong for me to defend myself? Should I just ignore what they say about me? And Moore says that part of the problem is that we often think wrongly about what it means to ignore. Ignoring something sounds passive, and yet ignorance, rightly defined, is active. In order to ignore well, we have to know well. So in other words, you purposely are not... And there are times to do this, but he says, Proverbs 2:26-4, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. The very next verse, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. There are times when responding is the right thing to do. But then he talks about the example of Christ. He says, I guess it's a prudential matter. When it comes to slander about himself, Jesus sometimes directly contradicted untruth. Sometimes he responded not with defense. He told stories. Quite often he ignored. One time he ridiculed the slander. Jesus modeled what it means to avoid the warning of Proverbs, that is to avoid sinning in response to sins against us. Let me see if there's anything actually substantive in this. Knowing your vulnerabilities. So he said he usually ignores untrue things about himself, or this woman did, I guess, and he agrees. If you have a tendency for quarrelsomeness or of an oversensitivity, you might be best served not not just by ignoring slander, but to try to avoid it. I don't think this is actually all that bad advice, to be honest with you. I know I'm saying that about Russell Moore. I don't think it's all that bad advice. This is an interesting example he gives. He talks about Jodie Foster responding to John Hinckley shooting a president to get her attention. And why does he bring that up? Let's see. There's sometimes quite different principles involved in defending others from slander than in defending oneself. Joseph forgiving his brothers for their injustice is commendable. If he had waved away their mistreatment of others, though, that would have been unjust. Generally speaking, Proverbs 27:2 says, let another praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger, not your own lips, often can be applied to questions of responding to lies about oneself. I'm trying to figure out why he brought the Jodie Foster thing up here. Maybe I don't get the reference. I'm too young. Yeah, I think I'm just too young to get the reference he's making there. It's part of history, though, right? I should know what Jodie Foster has to do with him. The first century church at Smyrna suffered slander. And then Jesus told them that he knew about the slander. And so Jesus is going to judge the woman who asked me or whether to respond to lies about her needs to know above all that Jesus knows the difference between the truth and lies. All right. So God's going to judge, basically. And he doesn't come down on any side. People thought this was about Megan Basham's book, and it probably is. I mean, knowing more, it probably is. And if that's the case, then you could probably take this. This is speculative to some extent, but I have watched the guy for a while as somewhat of an acknowledgement that, okay, you know, I'm going to say something. I remember the first time this happened early on when I was doing the podcast. It was Bruce Ashford. And I had said he was a provost at Southeastern Seminary. Since then, let's just say he's had some bad situations in his life, but he is no longer there. But he was sensitive. I had critiqued him signing, and not just him, others signing this evangelical immigration table document that really did. I mean, they said it wasn't promoting amnesty, but it kind of was. And I remember he responded with this whole article he wrote about trolls online and the different kind of trolls. And you could just sense the passive aggressiveness in, like, as he wrote this, but he wouldn't, like, I got the impression of, like, okay, he blew off some steam, but he won't like directly engage with me. He's not going to argue the point. And, you know, sometimes these guys think slander, any kind of criticism or critique is slander, which is just not. But I think it is a way to acknowledge, to signal to others that, like, hey, I know that I was attacked, but you can dismiss the attacks, which I think probably is more or less what Russell Moore's doing here. What happened to Russell Moore? Someone asked. I don't know what happened to him. I think he was always this way, probably to some extent. People say there's the old Russell Moore, the new Russell Moore, and he's gotten more left, but he was always, his start was Democrat politics in Mississippi, right? And I remember this article he wrote, it was so weird to me that he had thought that he would get into politics and marry someone like Hillary Clinton. And I thought, what in the world? That was during the time of the old Russell Moore too. All right. Jennifer says, education for kids, PragerU, Daily Wire, and Moms for Liberty have resources. I'm not saying they don't. I would say you can look into those. I would just be careful of all three of those. I don't know enough about Moms for Liberty. I'm generally probably positive about them, but I do know, especially PragerU, but Daily Wire stuff too. I know more the adult stuff, and I've definitely caught some very neoconservative and Proposition Nation stuff. So I'm not saying not to use them. Just, I think everything, though, this doesn't go even for these. It's just like everything. Just screen it. Parents really have to screen everything, unfortunately, these days. I think people want, and I understand it, you want like a trusted network that you can just turn on. I don't think they exist anymore, to be quite honest. Like, you have to just be aware of what's going on as much as possible. Okay, Jacob says PragerU and Daily Wire absolutely subversive. I haven't seen their kids programming. There's a fight about this now. All right. Our mega church in South Carolina recently sent out an email to all staff saying that Russell Moore was going to be speaking at the church and how good it would be considering the election. Okay. I'm not surprised about that. David Barton history. Cat. We have a cat. Okay. Says it's Dave Blaze TV. Someone says, okay. I don't know, guys. It's outside of my depth at this point with the kids show stuff. Let's talk a little bit. We're going to wrap up here soon. And any questions you have on any of the programs this week, I'll be happy to engage with. But let's talk about this sermon real quick. This is from J.D. Greer. And like I said, they re-released it online. I thought it was a new sermon, but apparently it was from about 10 years ago. And the name of the sermon is Standing in God's Way of Racial Integration. Standing in God's Way of Racial Integration. And it's from Acts chapter 10, verse 34 through 11, 17. So let's just go there real quick. And let's read some of that. If you go to, and this is, I think, part of a series, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see. Can we, let's see here. All right. So you should all be seeing that now, right? You can see what I've been, what I'm looking at. Acts 10. Oh, now I'm losing my place here. What did we say? 34 through 11, 17. So this is Peter. He says, I most certainly understand now that the gospel is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him, it does what is right is welcome to him. The word which he sent to the sons of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. You yourselves know the thing which took place throughout all Judea, starting with from Galilee after the baptism which John proclaimed. You know of Jesus of Nazareth, how God anointed him with the Holy Spirit. So he goes on. He says, while Peter was still speaking these words, the Holy Spirit fell upon those who were listening. So this is the story of Peter going and Cornelius's household, right? And yeah, Cornelius. And the Gentiles are now becoming saved. So I'm not going to read for you the rest of it, but this stems from the whole arise, Peter, kill and eat. What God has called holy, do not call unclean. And so the Gentiles are saved. And this is often, unfortunately, I think, a problem because this is really what this is a Jew and Gentile thing. And it's about the law. It's the law that the Jewish customs and the law that are the definitive feature here. And people often make this about something else. They often make it about some kind of, they import it into a modern context where it's these modern differences in the United States between different people groups and so forth. And it really wasn't that. This was specifically the Jewish people had these certain dietary restrictions and other things that they would operate by. And the Gentiles didn't operate by those things. And can the Gentiles still be Gentile and be saved? Can they practice the true religion? And the answer is yes. And so this isn't some kind of, like, this isn't civil rights integration stuff. But here you have J.D. Greer, and apparently they're still backing up this narrative. So he goes through the story a bit, and I think I don't want to focus on all of this. There's some specific lines that I thought were particularly interesting. The great white myth. When we repented of our racism, all the blacks would come rushing back into our churches, thanking their lucky stars they could worship with us. But what we learned is that a lot of black people preferred black worship and a lot of white people preferred white worship. A student to me complained about our church not being diverse enough. And then later our church was too demonstrative in worship, multicolored versus multicultural. A lot of times we want diversity, but we really don't. Not just in the church. I read an article in Atlantic that I guess backed this up, the neighborhoods people used to, they prefer mixed neighborhoods, but in reality, that's not where they live. I pointed this out with J.D. Greer, though. That's not where he lives either. That's part of the problem. Like, he wants to say these things, but where is Summit Church located? It's in an area. There's a lot of black neighborhoods there. Summit Church is in a very white area of Durham. So J.D. Greer, I can't see past this being just total hypocrisy. And that's what I guess virtue signaling would be, right? That, like, you're for these things, but you're not actually going to live that way. There's so much in here to talk about. I don't know if I want to talk about all of it. All racism comes from fear and insecurity. I need something to help me feel significant because I don't obtain my worth and significance from God. I'm just going to ask you, does this have anything to do with the story of Cornelius? We've left that. And that's part of the problem with Greer. He does this all the time. He does this when I have examined his sermons almost every time. He launches into some kind of application that, let's just say, that dog don't hunt. It's not in the text. Okay. He talks about we must prioritize diverse leadership. Racially diverse congregations always have racially diverse leadership. We want those on stage to send a welcome signal to all races, but they don't want tokenism. So you don't want to put an unqualified person in a position of authority simply because of their skin color. That is different than intentionally pursuing racial diversity. We're looking for qualified white people, black people, Asian people of every race. So it's again, like before he was saying, hey, there's all these people who want diversity, but they really don't. And he's one of them. But then there's this where it's like we want these diverse leadership, but at the same time, we don't want to just tokenism generally is, you know, you put someone, whether they're qualified or not, you feel the necessity to put someone of a different race in a position of authority or leadership or on a board just to make sure that it looks diverse. It's an optics thing more than anything else. And this is not an argument against tokenism saying, well, we just want to make sure that people are qualified. It can still be tokenism, whether they're qualified or not. But he doesn't want clearly a merit-based system here. He wants merit. He's saying, I want merit, but he wants it has to also be racially diverse. So these things can also compete with one another. What if you're in a situation where you can't have that? You don't have the numbers of people coming and there aren't people qualified to be in those positions. What do? You're creating this necessity that you must be diverse looking. So these things are incoherent. I want to skip to the end here. He says there's racism in their church. It's wicked and sinful. Some of you have experience with that. He's sorry for it. We're going to do everything we can to stop it. It's great when you say those things, you know, these things the world wants to bring a hammer down on you for. And, you know, it's no specifics. It's just, you know, our church is this way. It's like the Matt Hall, you know, I am a racist. Only J.D. Greer is like, our church has this problem. I don't go there. Maybe they do. My church, funny enough, my church doesn't have this problem. So what does that mean? Are we superior to like, yeah, it's a funny thing to be like the guys who are generally conservative are like, yeah, I go to churches. We don't seem to have this problem, but that may tell you something, right? If the guys who are more on the woke train are complaining about this, why do you have that problem at your church? Acknowledge that your sinful flesh is racist. Okay. Yeah. You are racist. Your cultural preferences, because you have cultural preferences, that makes you a racist. You feel superior because of your race. It's not necessarily a white thing or a Latino thing, an Asian thing. It's a sinful, depraved human thing. If you prefer your culture, guys, I mean, there's some bigotry there. Some of you should consider going into missions. Well, that's a great motive, right? You know, you could prove there you're not racist if you go into missions. And maybe that's what's holding you back. You're just too racist. You know, it's your community in quotes here. You want to leave your community and enter another. So here's what he said. This is what he says at the end. He says, we all must intentionally form relationships with people outside our comfort zone on all sides. If you don't do this, it will never happen. To not be intentional means to be intentionally non-diverse. You don't want to be intentionally non-diverse, do you? And I'm sure that's what was being talked about. That's what Peter was doing in Acts chapter 10 and 11, right? He was just, that's the moral lesson from it. He's like, you don't want to be intentionally non-diverse. It's silly. The whole thing's silly. They're still reinforcing this. They're still posting these kinds of things. It's just pathetic that we're still talking about these things. But 10 years later, what can we say about this? Is the church more diverse now? in America? Is the church more unified now? Are things healthier as a result of this messaging being crammed down everyone's throat? I would say it's much more fractured. It's much more balkanized. And this has obviously been a failure, and J.D. Greer should just preach the text and stop doing these silly applications. By J.D. Greer's standard, if he wasn't racist, he would move to Southeast Raleigh and put his kids in those schools. Yeah. He's not going to do that. Imagine the home value of J.D. Greer's house is well worth of $1 million. I don't know. I haven't looked into his house. So, could be. What is black worship? Where in the Bible is that required? Yeah, you're not going to find it in there, are you? Oh, man. What is white worship? Yeah, it's funny. You don't find these categories in scripture. I mean, you could say there's cultural things that different groups, hymns and so forth, but this is why I love the Reformed tradition and sticking to singing psalms and hymns and there being no ethnic cultural relevance to our worship, no partiality. I hate to break this to you, Kathy, but that is viewed as racist. And I have been told numerous times by people that this is split churches when you stick to those things, because it comes from, guess what? English speakers in Anglo parts of the world, whether it's England or the United States generally, who are reinforcing things like Scottish snaps and meters that are specific to those musical traditions and styles. You can't really escape culture. You're going to have culture. You can't transcend it and say, like, we're not going to have any cultural default. There is going to be a cultural default of some kind. And that's why I think some of this is silly. Greer wants to come to a situation where if you like mix all of these different cultures, if you have the right ingredients, you won't have one dominating the other, right? There won't be any dominance of any one culture or something like that. And I think there are people who are critical of that, more on the I don't know what you want to call them, but some people call it mid-Eva. I hate using that word, but I say little Eva. I used to, at least. Like, there's guys who are critical of that, but what they'll do is they're reaching for the same goal. Like, they want to transcend this. And so they're going to claim whatever their tradition is the neutral. Right. And then of course the woke people call them out and say, well, that's not neutral. That's hymns. Hymns aren't, that's not cultural. Singing hymns is cultural. Yeah, definitely. Singing hymns. I'm a music minister at my church. And so I have to make these calls all the time. And people submit songs they want me to do and so forth. And there's definitely cultural elements. And it's not just with place. It's also with time. So, you know, one area at one time has a different style than another. But there's development in art and music. And so, yeah, absolutely. Like, if you go to Africa, parts of Africa, and you want to do standard Anglican type hymns, Anglo-Protestant hymns, there are denominations and so forth that will do this. But even when they do them, they're not in the same way we would, generally speaking, at all. It's very different experience. So, yeah. Yeah. I don't want to poo-poo your point, Kathy, because you make a good point in that this is, you're looking at the theology of these things, right? You're looking at the richness, the depth. You're trying to evaluate things by that metric and say, the cultural things aren't at the front of your mind as far as like, we want Anglo-Protestant stuff here. Like, that's going to happen naturally depending on the makeup of your church, but you're looking at things more in terms of what will actually help us worship, right? And I think that is the right approach. And I think that's probably what you're saying there. So, all right. Now I'm hopefully not sparking a huge debate about that. Last but not least, I want to talk about this. Templeton. All right. So the Templeton Foundation, someone pointed this out to me, and maybe others have more information, but this guy, Thomas J. Ord, who wrote the book on LGBTQ normalization in the Church of the Nazarene, in one of his books, this is from 2004, The Science of Love. It says that this the Templeton Foundation Press helps intellectual leaders and others learn about science, research, and aspects of reality, invisible and tangible, spiritual realities, including unlimited love, accelerating creativity, worship, and benefits of purpose and persons in the cosmos. Interesting. So the Templeton Foundation is the one that put this out from Thomas J. Ord. So someone started getting curious and started looking things up, found out that the John Templeton Foundation has a religion, science, and society section on their website. And it's a grant, it's for grants. So you can get a grant if you want to learn about certain or research certain things. What can we learn from world's wisdom traditions about living good and purposeful lives? So this would not just be Christianity, but other religions and traditions. How are religious beliefs, practices, and communities changing and being changed around the world today? What does it mean to be spiritual, and how does it impact our beliefs, values, and customs? This is obviously not Christian. This is for the purposes of research, and it's broad, right? And they want to do, they have a goal though. The goal of this topical area is to advance our understanding of how people develop meaningful lives and pursue spiritual flourishing in a rapidly changing world. We are particularly interested in interdisciplinary projects. So let's see. Integration of religion, spirituality, or faith with the practice of healthcare. Facilitate community-based research designs. Examine the impact of faith-based communities on health of communities. It's pretty broad, pretty general. But they funded this guy in part. They funded some of the activities of this guy who's really pushing the needle left when it comes to LGBTQ stuff in the Church of the Nazarene. From the American Journal of Theology and Psychology, reviewing Thomas J. Ord's book, The Uncontrolling Love of God, it says that the Open and Relational Theologies group of the American Academy of Religion has been one of the best attended and most successful groups within the AAR. Let's see. Okay, he has, talking about Thomas J. Ord, he has considerable success in receiving funding from the Templeton Foundation for a number of projects. One of these was a marathon 2-week religion science conference at Eastern Nazarene University. The participants were evangelical theologians and scientists, along with liberal theologians who came from evangelical backgrounds. The conference wrestled with the ramifications of science for evangelicalism. I can only guess what that probably would have looked like with these liberal theologians there. And he's had considerable success getting all this money from this organization. So people ask the question, how does someone like a Thomas J. Ord, who doesn't believe in the Nazarene's doctrine on sexual ethics, how come he has so much influence? How come he's allowed to publish? How come for years he's allowed to be there? And I'm telling you, this is part of the reason. He's bringing with him, there's strings attached. There's money attached. I think that's a reasonable conclusion to draw, let me take it back one step. It's a reasonable suspicion to have that would motivate when there's strings like this. If you want to have your mind blown a little more, this is from the Two Windows Project, which is, let's see here. The organization was able to provide funding because of a grant received from the Templeton Foundation. So they got this grant, and they did a panel on Sunday, November 6th at the Midtown Church of the Nazarene. In the beginning, you know, it was science and theology conversation. So they held this event at a Nazarene church. This is 2016. Apparently, this is the same church, Loved to Love Church of the Nazarene. This is the same church that did Love Wins LGBT. Same place that's doing that, apparently. So I'm not saying the Templeton Foundation funded that particular thing, but that's the kind of church that the money is going to. And it's overtly pro-LGBT. Here's a review. I'm not going to get into this now. Conversations on Sexuality, a review of the Two Windows Project. So this Two Windows Project, which is funded by the Templeton Foundation, though, did a whole thing on and then got into LGBTQ community and the Christian community and these LGBTQ plus quote unquote issues. Templeton Foundation is funding some of this. Belmont University, this is a different grant. So that's the Templeton Foundation. And then I noticed this, I think Megan Basham first exposed this. I don't know if it was Megan, someone did. Belmont University receives grant to study how religion can reduce political polarization. What's the motivation of some of this? Belmont University professor will help lead a grant research project on how religion can reduce polarization. Belmont received $575,655. Well, that's a bunch of change. to grant, oh, here it is. Sorry, this is related to John Templeton. A grant from the John Templeton Foundation to support a 3-year cross-denominational survey. So my bad, this is also related. From the John, they're researching politics, religion, LGBTQ stuff gets put into here. The research is crucial for identifying approaches to increased tolerance and civility. So they want to heal this political divide. And they're going to do it. I didn't know that. Did I know that? Belmont was formerly Southern Baptist, I guess. Huh. So there's a large group of people out there who do not seem to want evangelicals to be politically active. At least they want to neutralize political support, because evangelicals have been overwhelmingly Republican for the last 40, 50 years. And there are groups that are willing to fund, this is what I think is happening, to fund the study of they're willing to do whatever they can to neutralize that voting block. I think that's what's going on here. That's my, and yes, that is the opinion of John Harris, but you don't see as much of this stuff coming from the right. It happens. Like there are, and there should be, right-wing think tanks and organizations that are funding biblical orthodoxy and moral integrity and these kinds of things. But I think the assumption has been that the left kind of tends to its own. Maybe they're funding that LGBTQ friendly church that's got a rainbow flag down the road. They're making inroads into your conservative denominations and organizations, guys. And they see that, like, the right doesn't do this to, like, the right isn't looking at, hey, look, the United Methodist Church, let's go, or the Presbyterian Church USA, let's give them a bunch of money to do something. The right-wing think tanks and organizations don't do that. Left-wing ones do. And so I think there's a subversive thing going in here. All right. That's it for the podcast. I'll take a few questions and then we got to go. No, that's not it. Okay. One last thing. I got to play this. This is from, who is this? N.T. Wright.
It is part of the internet and television and so on that it's picked up steam where people are unable to separate out issues. When I go to America, it always astonishes me that the same people are vitriolically opposed to abortion and vitriolically in favor of everybody carrying guns and being prepared to shoot people at any time. On the one hand, you'd have thought if they're so concerned about preserving human life, even in embryo and in vitro, etc., then why are they not concerned about preserving human life when it comes to, say, a school shooting by somebody who's been able to walk into a store, even though mentally disturbed, and buy a weapon-grade automatic rifle? I mean, for somebody from the other side of the Atlantic, and I suspect for you in Canada, this is just nonsense. And but if you try to...
All right, I can't take anymore. I'm sorry, guys. The clip does go on, but I can't take it. It's just, life is too short. And I did see Michael Bird this morning, and a guy from Australia, who's, I would say, more, he likes to be in the evangelical camp, but more liberal. And he was commending this, I guess. And it's people from Canada, Australia, Great Britain, they're going to have a different view on this, but there is a conflation obviously going on there. Abortion is murder, and securing firearms to not just defend oneself, but also for various purposes like hunting, protecting, cattle if you're out on the range somewhere. I mean, there's all these other purposes for it, sports shooting, whatever. That is not the same thing, having a gun. And so he's saying that the laws are such that someone who's mentally disturbed can just go get a gun. And that's not the case necessarily either. There are regulations, but there's going to be people who fall through the cracks. And because those people are out there and there are mentally disturbed people, then you need to be able to defend yourself. I saw in England a video, it went viral, of a knife attack. And these immigrant groups, I guess, it was a bunch of guys, immigrants, who were attacking this, looked like a native Briton guy, and stabs him in the neck. And this kind of, these stabbings happen all the time there, but you're not supposed to have, if I'm not mistaken, in Britain, I think that's even something that they've tried to regulate, if I'm not mistaken, knives. But if you're a law-abiding citizen and you're being attacked by someone who has a weapon of some kind, you can't defend yourself. And this guy didn't have a knife. He couldn't defend himself. And that's part of the reason in America we do have guns is to, because we want, it's the same motivation for conservatives who want to ban abortion because they want to preserve life and they want to punish murder, really. It's the same motivation for self-defense with guns. We should want to preserve life and defend against those who would try to kill people. And we have had several shootings, potential shootings, that were stopped by someone with a gun. So it's just silly. I think it's just because he's in England, to be honest with you. One more question and then I'm going to go. The fact that this astonishes NT Wright just goes to show that he is way overrated. He's an intellectual lightweight. He should have been named NT Wrong. Yeah. Well, I think, someone said, he illustrates the way why UK, Canada, and Australia have no freedom of speech, no First Amendment, no Second Amendment. Yeah. I don't know specifically what they have that don't. I just know they don't have the same laws that we do. Just trust the government, guys. They're the only ones wise enough to handle guns. Yeah. I do think that there are prudential reasons in certain environments to limit firearm ownership, or I shouldn't say ownership, but carrying firearms. You watch those old Western movies, and guy comes into town and is like, hey, we're not allowing guns in town. We're going to stop you. And, of course, that does make people vulnerable if there is one guy who has the gun. But that if you have law enforcement, it's a small town, I guess the idea is that the odds are better of less violence, especially if you have a group of people who are trigger happy in that scenario than there would be otherwise. If everyone was carrying a gun in a high trust society, everyone really can carry a gun. I think of like the Boers in South Africa, pretty high trust among themselves. They can carry weapons all over the place and they need them actually because of what they're undergoing. But they're not shooting each other. That's the example, the first example that came to mind. But when you have society, social disintegration, and you're trying to bring in law and order with a heavy hand, then I can see certain situations where you would want to limit that possibly. I think we get afraid of that, and rightly so, because we know, in our country, our experiences that that's going to lead to law-abiding citizens being taken, their protection being taken away from them. And so, in general, I oppose all of these things. But I'm just telling you, like, I can see it from the other side, or not the other side, but I can see, like, in a place like Great Britain, where, man, maybe Great Britain's not the best example actually, because I'm thinking of our inner cities. But if Great Britain has some of these parallels, I can see where you might, if you could like severely decrease the flow of guns, which you really can't very easily, in especially somewhere like the United States. Great Britain's an island, which maybe helps a little, but if you were able to severely decrease that and you had a strong law enforcement presence and people were just irresponsible across the board, we've got these murders in Chicago all the time. I could see limitations. I could see, requiring extra training or something, or extra vetting for a permit. I could see in the right situations these things, but we just don't have them. We don't trust our leaders, and we have too many people who are crazy who want to use guns to kill others, or knives. And what's a 5'3" woman going to do against a 6'2" guy with a knife? You give her a knife, it still doesn't even it, but if you give her a gun, it does. So I'm very much in favor of responsible firearm access to firearms and so forth. Thank goodness we don't have shootings at our gun-free public schools. Yeah. Because it's not realistic. It's unless you have like strong security and you check in everyone at the door and stuff, like if all it takes is one guy to get in, right? And then everyone's a sitting duck. That's part of the problem. I loved it at Liberty University where we were all encouraged to carry and you didn't know who was carrying and who wasn't. But again, Liberty University, the students, the teachers, generally, these are responsible people for them. It's not like other colleges that I won't name. And so it's a very safe place to be. I felt so safe there. And I knew there were professors that one of them I knew, he had a gun. He carried with him to class. It was great. I love that. But I trusted them. There was high trust. So all right, we got to go. I appreciate it, guys. God bless. More coming. Bye now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.